The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Winter words. Winter, season, weather. December, January, February. Scarf, hat, cap, beanie, mittens, gloves, sweater, jacket, coat, vest.
How shawl, should I prepare legging, for snow and ice? Boots, pajamas, put grit or cat road, litter on paths salt, and driveways booties, to lessen the risk of slipping on.
Is your vehicle snow ready for winter? Check that you have emergency kit available in your car. That should include ice scraper and de-icer, warm clothes and blankets for you and all passengers,
torch and let someone know when you expect to arrive.
Snowflakes, snowbank, snowball,
sun powder, drift, the glare of snow can be dazzling.
Icicles, crystals, frost, cold, bitter, windy, nippy.
Winter is a dominant thing. It's a six-month event. When I was growing up, winter in Montreal starts in November and ends sometime in late April. So it's a thing you have to go through, and it gives you the great gift of snow and ice. We have 6 feet of snow in Montreal, typically. Everything freezes up.
Gusting, frozen, frigid, sparkling, slippery. Winter words.
Somebody who spent every Christmas of my childhood in Africa, I've never really got this strange northern passion for the white stuff. Adam Gopnik, however, makes a good case in his new book Winter for the cultural and physical attractions of the Canadian winter, not least because it has brought him so much sport. Ice hockey, for instance.
And away we go in Hamilton. Messier getting it over to Howard Chuck, now back to Rochefort, to Crossman. Ahead on right wing to Glenn Anderson, who fires it in.
At a crucial moment in 1903, two of the stars of the Montagnard, Louis Hertebis and Théophile Viaud, were incited to cross over and play with the Irish Shamrocks, who were in a senior professional league, while the Francophone team continued to play in the intermediate league. The potential betrayal was a 6 days wonder in Montreal. Could these French kids leave the Montagnard for the Shamrocks, a much more visible team, playing as they did in the Victoria Arena, and do so without betraying their national Quebec identity? True, they would help the Shamrocks beat the rival English teams, but they would also be crossing over from one allegiance to another, from the east end of Montreal to the west. For a week or two, Hertebis and Viaud, a speedy winger and a rock-solid defenseman, had the whole weight of Quebec national identity on their shoulders. If they left the Montagnard, they would in effect become symbolic Irishmen. If they stayed with the Montagnard, they would remain ghettoized within the narrower precincts of the French-Canadian church-dominated culture and remain intermediates forever. We can only imagine today the pressure on those two kids. Improve your lot or declare your loyalty. Now, if you were making this movie in Anglophone Canada, you would have Hertebis and Viaud play with the Shamrocks, where they would overcome obstacles, and then all, French and Irish, would band together to beat some American team. And if you were making this movie in Quebec, you would have Viaud and Hertebis, after their flirtation with false Anglo-Irish glory, there's room here for a lovely Franco-Irish romance, you would have them go back to the Montagnard to assert their national identity in face of the temptations of assimilation. And if you were making a real documentary about what actually happened, well, they would take turns playing on both teams at once in the best Canadian way. For that seems to be what did actually happen. The best surmise in a murky story seems to be that they played a bit for one team and then a bit for the other. Canadianly, they found a compromise that involved never actually having to choose, keeping a dual identity and playing occasionally for both sweaters. The controversy does not so much come to a crisis and climax as just drift away in the cold winter air.
In front, Homotop scores! On the rebound, Andre Homotop, number 15. ties it up.
So where did the idea come from to look at the cultural history of winter?
It was a funny thing. I was standing on a chilly February day on a bus stop at 57th and Madison Avenue, and on my iPhone, I got an email, and I'm one of those people who compulsively checks their smartphone for their email, from Canada inviting me to give a series of lectures. And I thought, I want to talk about something that is Canadian, that pays tribute to my Canadian background, but that is universal in another way, that I can publish elsewhere and talk about elsewhere. And instantly, the idea of winter came to mind. I'd never read a cultural history of winter, and yet winter is the core national Canadian experience. And also instantly, I thought of all of the other things from Schubert to Caspar David Friedrich to Dickens that involved some idea of winter. And truly, on the bus on my way home, I saw the five things, the five R's that would be involved: recreational winter, romantic winter, and so on. And then I decided, and this was probably the single most significant part of that bus ride, I would dedicate it to my mother-in-law. And as I always say, we only had difficulties the first 20 years.
What does winter mean to a Canadian that it wouldn't to necessarily to us in these temperate climates?
Winter is a dominant thing. It's a six-month event. When I was growing up, winter in Montreal starts in November and ends sometime in late April. So it's a thing you have to go through, and it gives you the great gift of snow and ice. We have 6 feet of snow in Montreal, typically. Everything freezes up. And it means that skiing and skating, far from being recreations you have to go out in search of, are things that are literally there at your doorstep every day. We have the same relation to snow and ice that, say, Australians have to the surf. It's simply a part of your upbringing. And as a consequence, winter sports in Canada aren't something that you do, 2 weeks a year when you go on a trip. They're part of the fabric of everyday life. And when I think any Canadian thinks about Canada, they think about skating. Great Joni Mitchell song, River, speaks to everybody. A girl lost in the falseness of Los Angeles who's dreaming of skating on a Saskatchewan river. That's a song that goes deep into every Canadian heart. We love skating, and we have a national cult of the sport, which we alone fully appreciate. The Russians do too, I suppose, and that is ice hockey.
You argue in the book that it's only recently that we've come to love winter, that our appreciation of its deadly charms is a kind of modern phenomenon. Why is that?
Yes, I think that's true. I was doing a talk with my friend and colleague Anthony Lane yesterday, and Anthony, of course, who knows far more about everything than anyone, was pointing out, of course, that there's pre-modern winter art and winter music. That's certainly true. Bruegel on the one hand, Vivaldi, with whom this book begins in another way. I think that's true. But the clear sense of winter as a magical place, a special place, not just as one of the seasons, as a moment in the calendar, as it often is in medieval art, but as a thing to explore in itself, that's a modern idea. It's naturally in part because we no longer need be afraid of winter in the way that our ancestors do. We will survive winter. Central heating plays an enormous role in the invention of a romantic winter. And in fact, I write in the book about the guys who invented central heating. Here in Britain, actually, it was sort of like the Silicon Valley of the early 19th century, because inventing central heating was that important. Great Polish inventor came in and actually invented the radiator here. But so you have to be comfortable. You have to have the sense that outdoors is interesting, not terrifying, in order to have take pleasure in winter. And then two things happen. One is you discover the joys of the hearth. You discover the joys, the intimate delights, as the poet William Cowper puts it, of being inside in winter. That extends out to things like the cult of Christmas and domesticity. And then you also discover that since you'll probably get back in safe and warm, that you can be thrust out into winter, whether you're the melancholy wanderer of Schubert or you're an Englishman going to the Swiss Alps to discover skiing. So both of those kinds of movements, outward and inward, are possible once winter becomes less threatening than inspiring.
Yeah, you also talk about winter as a place to voyage to, a kind of remote place to explore. And you talk about the tragic fates of the polar explorers, yes, who still move us more than a century later. Why is that they're still so...
Fascinating question, right? We're obsessed with polar exploration. How many books about Scott and Shackleton are published every year, even though as episodes in British imperialism, they're of relatively little consequence? What draws us to those stories? And they are very much stories about winter. You know, one way you can see winter is geographically. You can say what happens is every year winter comes down to us from the pole, gets closer and closer like a 19th century cavalry charge, and then it stops and goes back up. But what if you go in pursuit of winter, which is exactly what the polar men did? It's a long and complicated story. I think one of the things that drew those guys to the activity was a kind of what I can only call a kind of monastic existentialism, a desire to see how you would survive just in the company of other men in the middle of the worst conditions that anyone could possibly imagine, the worst way, the best way of having a bad time, as Jerry Girard puts it, that anyone has ever invented, and then to see if you could survive it, if you could endure it. And it continues to appeal to us, I think, because it is the purest, kind of like pure 100% vodka courage. They simply were brave. And we read about Scott and Shackleton and their men. We read about Jerry Girard's winter journey where they went to collect the eggs of the emperor penguin in the dark, utterly frozen, so stiff they could barely move 10 steps a day and so on. And we say, they were brave. It wasn't like the bravery, say, of the exploration of the Nile, brave though that was, because there was a reasonable chance that you would make money and come home.
There's a kind of similar double pull at work in the appeal of Christmas as a festival of both reversal and renewal, isn't there?
I think there are two kinds of festivals in the world, exactly. There are reversal festivals like Halloween in America, like the Roman Saturnalia. The world turned upside down. Kids get to bang on doors and soap up windows, and you have to give them treats. And then there are renewal festivals like American Thanksgiving, like everybody's birthday, anniversaries, and so on. We say the world goes on as it should. And one of the things that makes Christmas so dense and fascinating as a holiday, even for those of us who are not Christians, is that it's both at once. It's a renewal festival. It's about the world going on. It's about our own lives and families coming together. And yet at core, it's a reversal festival. It says that tiny little crying baby in the manger, in the nativity, that's the big deal. That's the core of it. And the children who most resemble that crying baby are the core celebrants of this holiday.
Here in the UK, the essay is at a fairly low ebb, despite the efforts of specialist publishers like Notting Hill Editions, mm-hmm. or indeed Quercus here, right. with your own book. How are things in North America for the essay?
Oh, dead as a doornail. Nobody reads essays. Well, you know, it's a complicated question. The Belle Lettre essay, the great essay of Hazlitt or Beerbohm, is in some ways a museum piece, I suppose, now. The sort of thing you say, just the other day, I was turning over the leaves of my Elizabethan something or other. That kind of leisurely, high-minded essay is probably out. But, you know, almost everything that we read in the commercial press, in magazines and so on, really is a kind of essay. Most good book reviews these days are really essays, the way that a James Woods or Clive James or Louis Menand writes a book review is basically to get rid of the book in the first couple of paragraphs and then write an essay, which is essentially a condensed version of the book that the author should have written had he been as wise as James or Clive or Luke. I'm guilty of doing that thing myself. That's the form the essay takes now, or the kinds of things I write, which tend not to be, again, essays in the kind of, you know, meditation on a broomstick sort, but that nonetheless say, here's something that's going on in the world. Let me wrap it around with thoughts. It's another kind of essay.
So we need some sort of some impetus to get us essayizing.
Yes, I think that's right. You know, I wrote once, and I think it's true, that there are three kinds of essays left in the world that thrive. The review essay, the odd object essay, which someone like my friend Alain de Botton often writes. I often write, you know, there's a new five-blade razor. What are we to think of a new five-blade razor? Or what are we to think of the Euro as a design? That's another thing that gets us started. It's always a kind of news plug, the odd object essay. And then the memoir. You know, there's no more thriving genre in letters now. Maybe it thrives too much than the memoir. And the best memoirs tend to have a strong essay quality. They don't just tell you about what monsters your parents were. They brood on why your parents were such monsters. That's the essay part of the memoir. There's a lot of big talk, but then there's a lot of small looking to do. The essay is the part that's about the small looking. I hope in this winter book, for instance, that there's a kind of aha quality on many a page. That is, you say, I didn't know that. Really? Goethe was an ice skater, and they did great paintings of Goethe skating with his nose in the air and women throwing snowballs at him. I didn't know that. It's a small discovery compared to the immensity of Goethe's work. But for me, it's an essayist discovery because it says, you know what? There is a snowball aimed at every philosopher, and the essayist is on the side of the snowball.
Adam Gopnik talking to Richard Lee, from whom we'll hear more later. Adam's book, Winter, Five Windows on the Season, is published by Quercus. I'm still not so keen on snowballs, but Adam certainly encouraged me to take a more positive view of the Siberian winds that are sweeping across Britain this week. Though I have to say I did shiver in sympathy with one of our listeners, Jerry, who emailed us from Alaska, where the temperature is currently minus 40. Maybe a bit of wassailing would help, Jerry.
So you've made our wassail too, and I'll gladly sing to you. Fortune bless you and bring you a jolly new year.
Ah, wassailing. Cheers. One thing that never goes out of fashion. That's making merry with hot mulled punch in one of those ancient winter traditions I'm happy to observe. But what exactly was a wassail bowl? And what relationship does it have with the technology of the modern kitchen? If anyone can supply the answer to that question, it's Bea Wilson, whose latest production is a food book with a difference. Consider the fork.
From fire onwards, there is a technology behind everything we eat, whether we recognise it or not. Behind every loaf of bread, there is an oven. Behind a bowl of soup, there is a pan and a wooden spoon, unless it comes from a can, another technology altogether. Behind every chefy foam, there will be a whipping canister charged with nitrous oxide. Ferranadria's El Bulli in Spain, which until it closed in 2011 was the most celebrated restaurant in the world, could not have produced its menu without sous vide machines and centrifuges, dehydrators and packagettes. Many people find these novel tools alarming. As new technologies have emerged, there have always been voices suggesting that the old ways were best. Cooks are conservative beings, masters of quiet, repetitive actions, which change little from day to day or year to year. Entire cultures are built around cooking food one way and not another.
Bea, you talk in your opening chapter quite a lot about spoons, but your book isn't called Consider the Spoon, it's called Consider the Fork. Why did you choose the fork of all implements?
I think it's partly because of all the eating utensils, it's the one we most take for granted now. Any meal from the most grand Michelin-starred dinner to kind of greasy spoon breakfast would involve forks, or even if you're just kind of eating a kebab drunkenly on the way home from the pub, you'll have a fork. It might be a plastic one and it might break rather easily. And yet I was struck as I was doing the research just how recent in historic terms the fork is, and that until a few hundred years ago, people in Britain certainly thought the idea of putting strange metal prongs into your mouth along with food was bizarre, effeminate, unnatural. And I think that's why I said Consider the Fork as the title rather than spoons are ancient. I mean, spoons are just an obvious utensil which pretty much every culture in the world has adopted, whereas forks are recent, they're specific to Western ways of eating. And I also found that the adoption of the knife and fork at table, which, I mean, it now just seems to us a trivial matter, knives and forks, you know, a question of etiquette or table manners, but it actually had profound impacts on the human body, changed the alignment of our jaws.
Oh, this is a really interesting thing, yes.
I couldn't really believe this when I first read it. So there's an American anthropologist called C. Loring Brace, and he began working on human teeth going way back in the 1960s. And he first got very interested in the idea that we used not to have the overbite. So as any orthodontist will tell you, the normal alignment of human teeth is an overbite where the top layer of teeth fits over the bottom layer, a bit like a lid on a box. Whereas apes have an edge-to-edge bite, which is more like a guillotine blade sort of banging against one another. But what Brace found was that until very, very recently, human beings had an edge-to-edge bite as well. And the change happened far too recently for there to be any Darwinian evolutionary explanation. I mean, he found that in the West, it only goes back about 250 years, and he thought that's very strange. Nothing really changed in the substance of a rich Western diet at that time. But what did change was that we went from eating hunks of meat using just a knife and our fingers and sort of carving away at it and stuffing things in our mouth regularly, which meant that our teeth were being used as clamps and getting gradually worn away, to using a knife and fork and cutting things into small morsels before we pop them into our mouth. And Brace's great theory was that this must have been the change which explained this transformation of our jaws. And I found this just staggering, that something as apparently trivial as a knife and fork could change our bodies.
How did that work in China, where they use chopsticks?
Well, that's the amazing thing. So you think, well, what about China? And what Brace found, it took a while for him to get the evidence, because complete human jaws from that many hundreds of years ago aren't easy to come by. But he found that in China, the change was seen 900 years earlier. And it corresponded, again, with the adoption of chopsticks and food being cut up into tiny morsels. And I had goosebumps when I first read that, because you just think, that's really bizarre that the way we eat could change us.
And this isn't the only example of that, is it? Because in your section on fire, you quote Richard Wrangham, who wrote a book, Catching Fire, which actually posits the idea that it was cooking that enabled our brains to grow.
He did. I mean, it's a wonderful book. So his thesis is that it was a previous school of anthropologists argued that it was meat eating that made us human. But Wrangham, entirely convincingly to my mind, argues no, it was the first act of cooking that enacted that first transformation of the brain from primate to human. And that's amazing. So, cooking is something fundamental to being a human being.
Why did it do that? How did it do that?
It enabled us to access a far wider range of ingredients than we'd ever have had before. When you cook food, you access more of the calories than you would do by eating it raw. The brain is an extremely greedy organ. It needs a lot of energy to grow. So by cooking food, it meant that whereas before it would have taken a lot of energy to gather enough food to have your daily subsistence, so the discovery of cooked food left us with surplus energy for brain growth.
You quote Kratzenberg's first law, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. Will you decode that a bit for us?
I will. Well, if you look at something like the pestle and mortar, for example, that is something which has changed in form very little in 10,000 years. If you go back to the sort of grinding tools of Mesopotamia, they would look probably quite similar to the sort of craggy pestles and mortars that you can buy in fancy kitchenware shops today. But in social connotations, the pestle and mortar has completely changed. It's gone from being an instrument of torture, more or less, which women mostly were having to use to grind enough basic subsistence to get a family through the day, to being something that we just use for fun on the weekend. It's a leisure tool now that we use for making pesto or Thai curry pastes when we feel like it after work or at the weekend.
Technologies are also combined, aren't they? Your pestle and mortar in Africa is used to pound cassava, which is then boiled, which renders a toxic cyanide-bearing root edible, in fact makes it into a staple for a large part of the world.
Absolutely. And then what the crucial technology that the cassava needed was the cooking pot. And I think sometimes we, when we talk about kitchen technology, a lot of times when I was trying to explain to people what I was writing about as I was doing the book, they said, oh, I don't like high-tech cooking, or I don't like technology in the kitchen, oh, I can't bear too much of that. And the thing I kept coming back to again and again was that there's technology even in these things which we think are not technology at all, like a basic stainless steel pot is a really remarkable thing. It enables us to combine flavours, to boil things. And the invention of pottery, or the adoption of pottery as a widespread form of cooking around 10,000 years ago, for me, is the beginnings of real cuisine. And that's the point when cooking becomes something we would recognise as cooking, when you can intermingle flavours. And as you say, you can eat things for the first time, like cassava, which otherwise would have been poisonous.
How did the first person realise that it was edible, this thing that would presumably have poisoned them?
I think the experimentation would happen very gradually over many generations. I mean, the evidence from ancient pottery seems to be often, you'd think that the pot is such a useful thing that it's obvious that once a culture had discovered the means of making clay and firing it, that they would think of using it for cooking. And often that isn't the case. You'll find communities where they use pottery just for religious purposes for many, many years before they think of using it as a cooking pot.
You make the point that lots of cultures all over the world discovered pots at the same sort of time.
I don't know how that happens. I don't know whether any anthropologist has explained how that happens. I mean, part of it is that technologies always go together. And so you can't ever see any of these things in isolation. I mean, say, for example, there's a whole technology of spit roasting where you can't understand a spit without an open hearth, without all of the other tools to go along with it. If you come back to the example of pottery, it's joined very intimately with the other technology of agriculture. I mean, what pottery enables us to do is to have staple grain foods for the first time. And what you see happening is all over the world, at the point that people move from a hunter-gatherer existence to a farming existence, that also goes along with cooking pots. But then there are exceptions, because I mean, there were Pacific Islanders who had the chance to use pots and decided not to.
Maybe they had shells to use instead. Which were the first pots in a way, weren't they?
People say that shells were the first pots. And I just don't see how you can use a shell quite in the same way as a pot. I mean, it's yes, you can cook shellfish in its own shells, as we all know from Moulmerinière. And there was a theory you keep coming across in the literature of how turtle cookery must have led to pottery. But you can't really cook anything in a turtle shell except for a turtle. Whereas the wonderful thing about a cooking pot is you can put anything in it.
Now, let's scroll forward to the late 19th century, which is when the labour-saving device began to come into its own. And you have a lovely story about the giant egg beater boom of the 1870s in the US.
This was extraordinary. I mean, over a very short period of time, suddenly there was this mass of new egg beater invention. I mean, I think there were over 600 patents issued between something like the 1850s and the 1910s. And yet, when you look into them, I mean, they all had various different designs. The most famous one was this one called the Dover, which is the rotary to...
Which my mother still had one in the 1950s
yes,
and 60s.
Loads of people still have them in their kitchens, and you can still buy them in kitchenware shops. I find them really annoying because you've got to use two hands and they slide around in the bowl. And compared to a French balloon whisk, which has been in existence since the 16th century in Italy...
You posit a theory that it answered a desire in middle-class American women not just to get more air into their eggs, but to get more labour out of their servants. Mm. That's very cynical, isn't it?
There's an account in a contemporary American cookbook by someone called Marion Harland. She describes bringing home various designs of egg beaters and handing them to her servant, her cook, and saying, you know, have a go with this. And then the poor cook attempts it and it all goes horribly wrong and the eggs end up on the floor. And then finally she buys the Dover, which is her preferred brand. And she finds that the cook is finally able to make egg whites that will meet her satisfaction. So things like a food processor or a handheld blender, if you were going to be doing that cooking anyway, let's say, save labour. Whereas then there's other ones which just give you the illusion of saving labour. And I think the egg beater boom was that. I think it was a transitional period when middle class women in America, yes, they might still have a cook, but they would only have one cook as opposed to two. Or maybe they couldn't quite afford a cook anymore. And they were suddenly wanting someone to feel that they were on their side in this task of producing tremendously airy sponges. And also there is, as always with these things... It was a case of what raw materials were around. I mean, the cast iron industry was avidly looking for ways to offload metal in various forms. And you find in the mid-19th century America all kinds of kind of tabletop clamped objects from apple peelers to cherry pitters, all of which the ironmongers would have done very well out of.
Moving forward to now, you create this vision of a modern kitchen with the insatiable box that is the fridge right at the centre of it. Not the oven anymore, it's the fridge that you say is at the centre of the modern kitchen.
I would argue that the fridge has taken over from the oven as the focus around which we build our kitchens and arguably our lives. If you speak to kitchen designers, they will say, yes, the fridge is the single iconic item that people choose first and then they decide how to assemble the kitchen. Whereas the literal meaning of focus is fireplace. So it always would have been the fire. Whereas now the starting point of a kitchen is going to be a fridge. I think it's partly that the fridge has genuinely completely transformed the way we not only cook but shop for food. And in Britain, it's pretty recent. I mean, in America, fridge ownership goes back at least to the 1930s, if not the 20s, there's this desire to kind of fill them up, isn't there? I mean, things like yogurts were barely consumed before people had fridges, because before that we had hot, comforting, milky puddings. But once you've got this thing with its beautiful shelves and its little compartments, you want to have some shiny little tubs of something that you can put on the shiny compartments.
If you were to look forward to the 21st century, at the beginning of which we now are, what do you think the single most important technological advance will be, say, in the next 30, 40 years?
My main predictions would be continuity. I think we will continue remarkably to cook with wooden spoons and pots and pans. Whatever else may enter the kitchen, I think those will stay.
Call up the butler of this house, put on his golden ring. Let him bring us up a glass of beer and bed of bichazine. Love and joy come to you and to you, your master, too. And God bless you and send you a happy new year.
B. Wilson's Consider the Fork, A History of Invention in the Kitchen is published by Particular Books. So what are you lining up as presents for your family and friends this Christmas? A wooden spoon? I doubt it. I bet a bunch of you have gone out and bought a Kindle or two. Fie upon you! You won't be getting any thank you letters from three of our favourite writers, Philip Hentscher, John O'Connell or Ian Sansom, for they've all chosen the giving season to speak up for the slow pleasures of handwriting and paper and the old-fashioned epistolary arts. Ah, Richard Lee has found his true home.
Ah, the modern world. All that rush and commotion, all that fuss and technology. Confusing, isn't it? These days, we take for granted the miracles of instant communication, from Twitter to texting, from email to the telephone. But as we update our status with the details of our latest sandwich, are we losing more than our sense of perspective? This winter, three writers line up to mark the decline of handwriting, to sing the praises of paper, to investigate whether, as the digital world sweeps away our analogue lives, there's a baby to be salvaged from the almost airborne bathwater.
I do a lot of improvisational exercises in a notebook that I write by hand. Then when I'm writing like any homework, or if I'm writing a chapter of the young adult novel, then I do write directly onto the laptop. But handwriting is good for getting ideas out.
Technology has advanced so far that you can always type things out on your phone, but yes, there is a certain primal joy, if you will, about just writing using a pen and, you know, feeling the pressure, the ache in your hand, and I do that often.
Ian Sansom celebrates the stuff we used to write on in paper. Not, as he says, strictly speaking, a history of paper, but a personally curated paper museum, a musée imaginaire. Philip Hentscher laments the passing of penmanship with The Missing Ink, an account of handwriting, teaching and interpretation spliced with personal reflections and interviews with friends and family. John O'Connell puts pen to paper with a history of slow communication for the love of letters, moving from questions of letter-writing materials to questions of letter-writing style, asking whether the physical encounter between nib and sheet offers a more intimate connection than communications networked by a keyboard and screen. Contrasts between the three books can perhaps best be summed up by what happens when their authors go in search of fresh supplies. Hentscher decides he wants an upgrade to his trusty Lamy fountain pen and sets off for Peter Jones. After spending most of the day on a wild goose chase through luxury London, contending with foolish fellow shoppers and substandard assistants, he winds up buying a Lamy just like the one he already has. Sansom, who says he dresses like a vaudeville comedian or a character in a play by Samuel Beckett so as to maintain his serious book-buying habit, tells in an aside of wandering absent-mindedly into Smytheson on New Bond Street, where, realistically, he says, he couldn't even afford a pack of cedar pencils. O'Connell, however, after drawing a blank in W.H. Smith and Paper Chase, finds true love in the very same shop, purchasing 50 sheets of Smytheson's plain writing paper in a dandy Nile blue box with envelopes to match. But what's the appeal of writing with burgundy red ink on a sheet of exclusively milled paper complete with a distinctive watermark? I've come here to the bustle of New Bond Street to ask Smytheson's chief executive, Andy Chernowski.
Via text messages, via emails, via all these different means of technology, we're losing that human connection. We're losing the meaning of those words. If you devote the time to handwrite on exquisite paper, it is a different experience. It elevates. You can see that the person who's writing to you values you, because they're taking the time to connect with you at a very different level. And a way that human beings used to do, and not so long ago.
I'm wondering, when the last time you managed to make the time to write a letter yourself?
I write notes every single day. I wrote a note to a friend who was an art director, and we sent him some catalogs and some gifts, etc. The more special the occasion, the more you need that connection, the more you need that physical presence. So I cringe at the thought of going to someone's house, or worse yet, having someone come to my house for dinner and receiving a text in response kind of thing. Whether it be a thank you for a dinner party or the birth of a new baby or a happy birthday, how much more beautiful it is to receive that via a piece of paper in the post. It's really quite lovely.
But is this obsession with the materials of writing anything more than shallow ostentation? Sanson quotes the scholar and craftsman David Hunter's belief that papermakers needed unusually robust constitutions because of their constant stooping over the vat. After all, one man's handmade luxury is the result of another's back-breaking toil, sheet after sheet after endless weary sheet. Surely all this painful fetishism only gets in the way of the issue that's really at stake here, what we're trying to say. Not according to the novelist Russell Kellen Jones.
I write with a pen, but a good pen, actually, a Mont Blanc. It's a treat I gave myself maybe 10 years ago, and it's still a treat to pick that up, you know, brown ink, sometimes I change it to blue ink. But the aesthetics of seeing your work come out of a pen is very different to what you produce on a computer. That seems so finished to me. It seems like a final draft, and that's one of its problems. So I like the process of writing longhand, editing longhand, and then producing it on a screen, which also has a slightly different aesthetic to the printed version. So in a sense, there are three stages, and each one produces a graphic sensibility, I suppose, and they also can affect what the language is doing. So there's a sort of relationship between graphics, I think, and language itself. And also the other thing too is the speed of thought and the speed of handwriting are synonymous in a way that some people can write on screen faster than they can actually process the thoughts that they have. And it sort of does something to the way consciousness works.
Do you change your ink with your mood or with your content?
With my birthday. It's nice to use different colours, and I sometimes have brown ink, blue ink, black ink at hand. So every now and again I flush the pen out and change the ink itself. I see it go down the sink. I feel slightly forlorn, you know, and also then it gets on my hand invariably, and it's slightly indelible for about 4 or 5 hours, and that's something which I feel is quite good because it taps me into the notion of being a craftsman. In other words, you know, I've got dirty hands. You know, I've been working down the coal mine. I've been a plumber. I've been a carpenter. You know, it's a craftsman's like stain that I rather like, actually.
You don't ever worry that the focus on the kit is a kind of a form of prevarication?
Well, it's a fetishism, but there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, they are the tools of the trade. I have a writer has got a very small toolbox, in which there would be, you know, a computer, maybe a mobile phone, you know, a notebook, pens, maybe a book, you know, some serious piece of work that you like to refer to again and again, and that's about it, you know.
For the novelist and poet Julia Bell, writing with a pen is a physical thing.
I use a very nice old-fashioned ink pen, which actually ends up going all over my fingers, but I only use that at home, and I used to practice my handwriting because we had dictation at school, and I remember very clearly changing my A's to make them into sort of like copperplate letters as a way of making the dictation more interesting. There's something interesting about the physical relationship with the page, and I like writing poetry, and I can't write poetry straight onto the screen. It doesn't have the same feeling. You can see the shape of a poem when you write it on the page, whereas if you type it out, it doesn't have the same. You don't have the same emotional relationship with it, I don't think. I think writing poems is a physical thing. It's like a movement of emotion coming through me onto the page, and I think onto the screen feels very sterile. And that would be the place where I might edit, or I'd type something up and change it. But onto the page is it feels like a real connection between my emotions and my fingertips and then the page. It's much more intimate.
Thank you. The irresistible rise of the digital may bring publishers and newspapers tumbling down, but despite the elegiac tone struck by Sansom, Henshaw and O'Connell, pen and paper will be with us for some time yet. Witness the tatty sheets of scrawled notes wedged into my copies of all three volumes. But if Julia Bell is right that writing is in some sense a physical thing, that writing on a screen suffers from an unavoidable loss of intimacy, then what can we do? For John O'Connell, the answer is simple. Sit down and write someone a letter.
I'm sitting at the kitchen table. It's 9:15 p.m. and the children are asleep. A standard lamp behind my left shoulder casts the only light. In front of me is a sheet of Smithson's paper. In my right hand, I'm holding the Mont Blanc fountain pen my wife bought me about 10 years ago. I filled it with burgundy red ink from one of those beautiful shoe-shaped Mont Blanc ink bottles, the ones with the last drop reservoir at the front. Dear Jane, you probably don't remember, but back in, was it October, you wrote me a wonderful letter. I want to call it a condolence letter, but it did so much more than condole, and I've meant ever since to reply in a manner that felt worthy, that acknowledged not just what you wrote, but the effort you put into writing it, and I know how much else you've got going on. That it's taken me so long is faintly shameful. I can only plead lack of perspective. It vanishes after a death, as you know, and so much has happened since the funeral.
Nothing but the finest vellum will do for me this Christmas, and I'm sure I've got an old Parker pen stashed somewhere away in the drawers. But don't go away, because we will be bringing you a veritable feast of listening to see you through the Christmas and New Year period. We have book clubs by Hilary Mantel and Colm Toybean, and a series of the finest short stories read by some of the best-known authors, from Hanif Qureshi to Nadine Gordimer, Richard Ford to Zadie Smith. So stay with us, subscribe, tell your friends to sign up. But for now, thanks to B. Wilson, Adam Gopnik, Richard Lee, and all those paper enthusiasts. From me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Welcome to our winter festival. Feast on mince pies, be dazzled by a magical Christmas bell.
Here we come a wandering so fairly to be seen. Northern joy come to you, and to you I will sail too. God bless you and send you a happy new year. God send you a happy new year. We are not daily beggars that beg from door to door, but we're the neighbour's children.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.